Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A month since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, people's health needs there are dire and getting worse. UN Health Agency Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on Wednesday, the situation is particularly critical in Mariupol and elsewhere, Tedros said, where the World Health Organization, or WHO, has not been able to dispatch a humanitarian convoy because of the ongoing violence. Other Ukrainian cities have received 150 tons of medical supplies from the WHO hub in Lviv in western Ukraine, but access to many locations remains blocked. Tedros issued an appeal to Russia to stop the war before condemning ongoing attacks on hospitals, patients and medical staff.
WHO has now verified 64 attacks on healthcare since the start of the war, and we are in the process of verifying further attacks. Attacks on health must stop. Health systems, facilities and health workers are not and should never be a target.
UN Chief Antonio Guterres set an ambitious five-year global deadline on Wednesday to ensure that people worldwide are protected by early warning systems against extreme weather and climate change. Marking World Meteorological Day, Mr. Guterres said that early warnings and action save lives. He added that the World Meteorological Organization, or WMO, would lead the effort and present an action plan in November at this year's UN Climate Conference, or COP27, in Egypt. Mr. Guterres warned that human-caused climate disruption is now damaging every region and that it was unacceptable that one-third of the world's people are still not covered by early warning systems. This mainly involves least developed countries and small island developing states, and the situation is even worse in Africa, where 60% of people lack early warnings on storms, heat waves, floods and drought. World TB Day is marked on the 23rd of March, and this year the World Health Organization, WHO, has called for urgent investment in the fight against tuberculosis to save millions more lives. Although TB is preventable and curable, it remains one of the world's deadliest infectious killers. Each day it claims more than 4,100 lives, and close to 28,000 people fall ill after becoming infected. And this, despite the fact that 66 million lives have been saved since 2000. The need for global action is more urgent than ever, the WHO said, as the COVID-19 pandemic has reversed years of progress in preventing TB transmission, meaning that for the first time in over a decade, TB deaths increased in 2020. Conflicts across Eastern Europe, Africa and the Middle East have made vulnerable populations more susceptible to TB, underscoring the need to ensure that commitments made by global leaders to end TB are met. The UN Health Agency said that global spending on TB diagnostics, treatments and prevention in 2020 was less than half of the annual global target of $13 billion. For research and development, an extra $1.1 billion per year is needed. In Kenya, a sustainable agriculture project has helped farmers move away from the harmful practice of growing tobacco in favour of a healthier alternative, the UN said on Wednesday. The scheme offers training to tobacco farmers so that they can switch to alternative crops that are easier to harvest, such as beans. So far, growers have sold 135 tonnes of beans to the World Food Programme, or WFP, providing them significantly more income than from tobacco farming. Growing beans has the added advantage that they're full of iron, which helps to counter numerous health and development problems among children and pregnant women. The project has seen farmers' health improve, increased school attendance from children previously working on farms, and better crops for the environment replacing tobacco, said UN agencies WHO and FAO, who noted that tobacco farmers and their families are exposed to serious health risks from the nicotine that is absorbed through the skin when handling wet tobacco leaves, exposure to heavy use of pesticides, and to tobacco dust. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a fresh look at Russia's war in Ukraine through the eyes of our guest, Chris Hedges.
He was a war correspondent for 20 years. He had a show on RT television, which the United States government has blocked. We open up our airways to our friend, Chris Hedges.
We also speak today with Professor Donna Murch, author of the new book, Asada Taught Me, State Violence, Racial Capitalism, and the Movement for Black Lives.
This is an important book. Donna Murch is the historian of the Black Panther Party, and she's got a lot to teach us, as does Asada.
Stay with us.
I'm
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The British Supreme Court has refused journalist Julian Assange's appeal, and he's now in line to be extradited to the United States for trial and certain conviction of espionage. Jim, what was Stella Morris, his companion's, reaction to that decision?
Yes, Stella Morris, who I'm happy to say, and she's happy to say, is now the wife of Julian Assange, did issue a statement upon that ruling. Here is that statement. Just this morning, on our way to school, our four-year-old son asked me when Daddy will come home. Julian's life is being treated as if it were expendable. He has been robbed of over a decade of liberty and 3 years from his home and his young children, who are being forced to grow up without their father. A system that allows this is a system that has lost its way. Whether Julian is extradited or not, which is the same as saying whether he lives or dies, is being decided through a process of legal avoidance, avoiding to hear arguments that challenge the UK court's deference to unenforceable and caveated claims regarding his treatment made by the United States, the country that plotted to murder him, the country whose atrocities he brought into the public domain. Julian is the key witness, the principal indictor, and the cause of enormous embarrassment to successive U.S. governments. Julian was just doing his job, which was to publish the truth about wrongdoing. His loyalty is to, well, the same as that which all journalists should have, to the public, not to the spy agencies of a foreign power. He published evidence that the country that is trying to extradite him committed war crimes and covered them up, that it committed gross violations that killed tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children, that it tortured and rendered, that it bombed children, had death squads, and murdered Reuters journalists in cold blood, that it bribed foreign officials and bullied less powerful countries into harming their own citizens, and that it also corrupted allied nations' judicial inquiries into U.S. wrongdoing. For this, that country wants him in prison for 175 years. Now the extradition will formally move to a political stage. Julian's fate now lies in the hands of Home Secretary Priti Patel. This is a political case, and she can end it. It is in her hands to prove that the UK is better than all of this. Patel can end Britain's exposure to international ridicule because of Julian's incarceration. It takes political courage, but that is what is needed to preserve an open society that protects publishers from foreign persecution. The cruelty against Julian is corrupting. It corrupts our most cherished values and institutions. They will be extinguished and lost forever unless this travesty is brought to an end. The fight for freedom will go on until he's freed.
Thank you for reading that, Jim. How can our listeners learn more about Julian Assange and come to his defense?
Very simply, go to Assange Defense, all one word, AssangeDefense.org. AssangeDefense.org. You'll see everything that we've gathered there about all of his supporters, about all of the chapters around the country of that defense committee working for his freedom, and how individuals who still believe in freedom of the press in this country and in freedom for Julian Assange can help make that a reality. And now our continuing coverage of Russia's war in Ukraine. Today we take a look at the role the United States and NATO played in Russia's decision to go to war, the fears of a yet wider war in Europe, the peace talks now underway and what it will actually take to end the war, and the portrayal of the war in the corporate U.S. media. Our guest for this topic is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges spent 20 years as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, where he served as their Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkans Bureau Chief. In 2002, he was part of a team of New York Times reporters who won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of global terrorism. But in 2003, when he spoke out publicly against the U.S. war in Iraq, and the Times then issued him a formal reprimand and told him not to speak out again against the war, he resigned and became a fellow at the Nation Institute. He also hosted a popular and important show on RT television until that network was shut down by the United States. And in addition to his highly heralded Collateral Damage book, Chris Hedges has written a number of other well-received books, including American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. And in addition to his highly heralded book, Collateral Damage, more recently, Chris Hedges has written a new book, Our Class. Well, Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Chris, recently you wrote a piece for the Sheer Post where you reminded the readers that, and I quote, "After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was near universal understanding among political leaders that NATO expansion would be a foolish provocation against Russia," close quote. And in that same article, you note that a classified diplomatic cable, obtained, by the way, and released by WikiLeaks, dated February 1st, 2008, written from Moscow and addressed to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, NATO-European Union Cooperative, the UN's National Security Council, and others, made it clear that there was, and again I quote, "an unequivocal understanding that expanding NATO risked an eventual conflict with Russia, especially over Ukraine," close quote. Can you briefly summarize what that understanding was between Russia and the West after the collapse of the Soviet Union, where NATO was concerned, and how that understanding has been dishonored by America and NATO?
Well, first of all, I was there. I was in Eastern Europe in 1989 reporting on the revolutions that overthrew the communist regimes that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that was a moment of tremendous hope. We thought naively, of course, that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, NATO had been rendered obsolete. Gorbachev had reached out to Washington and to Europe. He was proposing a new security pact, which would include Russia. James Baker, the Secretary of State in the Reagan administration, along with the West German foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, along with Margaret Thatcher, all assured Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany. The French also made this commitment. And there was this moment when we thought we were seeing a new global order. People began to talk about the peace dividend. The West would no longer, along with the Soviets, would no longer have to pump massive expenditures into their military and weapons systems, including their nuclear weapons systems. And there was universal agreement among even people like Henry Kissinger, universal agreement that an attempt to expand NATO was an unwarranted provocation against Russia, and that it would essentially destroy the agreements and the commitments that had been made, and the possibility of a new world where we had not divided through the Cold War, divided the globe into us and them. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. And you mentioned the WikiLeaks cable, so it was fully understood what this provocation would do. We have to remember that the memory of the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in World War II, which devastated huge swaths of the country, I think 20 million Russians were killed. There's essentially a plain. I mean, it's a flat plain between the Eastern and Central Europe and Moscow. Napoleon, of course, did the same thing a century earlier. And so what we saw was essentially, I believe, the weapons industry, which saw a multi-billion dollar bonanza by refitting the old communist bloc countries in Eastern and Central Europe with NATO equipment. I mean, Poland, for instance, just signed a deal, a $6 billion deal for M1 Abrams tanks. And so the march began. And we have to remember how many countries have been absorbed now by NATO: Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, and North Macedonia. And so this was fully understood, and that diplomatic cable, another reason we owe so much to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, was from 2008. It was written from Moscow. It laid out that Russia perceived encirclement by NATO and efforts to undermine their influence in the region as a violation of the security interests, that they were worried about the divisions in the Ukraine. This is all in the memo over NATO membership, with the ethnic Russian community, of course, against membership, which led to the split, in particular the split in 2014 when we intervened to overthrow a kind of Moscow-friendly regime. The memo predicted violence, and at worst, these are their words, civil war. It said, I'm quoting, in that eventuality, Russia would have to decide whether to intervene, a decision Russia does not want to have to face. And then it quotes Dmitry Trenin, who at the time was the deputy director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, who expressed concern that Ukraine was, in the long term, the most these are his words, most potentially destabilizing factor in U.S.-Russia relations, given the level of emotion and the quest for NATO membership, and that with Russian intervention, you very well could see U.S. overt, these are again from the memo, encouragement, opposing political forces, leaving the U.S. and Russia in a classic confrontational posture, and that's precisely where we are.
The corporate media's coverage of Russia's war on the Ukraine has been heart-wrenching, bringing the human misery caused by the Russian assault on the Ukraine into all of our living rooms. This is not the case when the U.S. and NATO went into Iraq or Afghanistan. We did not see the U.S. doing to their countries what their and their people, what's being done now in the Ukraine. And we do not see in our TVs their children crying, their homes destroyed. Talk to us, Chris, about the role the mainstream media is playing and what we in America know about the background to the Ukraine war and how it's being fought and whether Russia is really acting all that differently from the way America did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, it's acting differently in that it has yet to destroy entire city centers the way we did with Shock and Awe in Baghdad. And I wrote a column also for Sheer Post, picked up by Salon and other places. You can find it on Sheer Post, called Worthy and Unworthy Victims, which addresses precisely that point. The terror that we and our allies carry out, whether in Palestine, Syria, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Iraq, is dismissed as kind of the regrettable cost of war, collateral damage. We do the same thing Moscow does. I'm not defending, by the way, the invasion of Ukraine. It's an act of preemptive war, which under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. But Moscow was baited. They pull the trigger. They're guilty, but they were baited. And so the same thing that Moscow is saying about its military, we say about ours. Having been around, having been a war correspondent for 20 years and been around these kind of massive pieces of ordnance, so the missiles, the 500, 1,000-pound iron fragmentation bombs, mortars, heavy artillery tank shells, belt-fed saws, it is insane to think that once you begin to use these industrial weapons in a populated area, there isn't going to be tremendous amounts of civilian casualties, which is true in the Ukraine, but it was also has been true in our misguided preemptive wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. But what the media does is what it always does. It's what the Russian media that's now controlled by the Kremlin is doing in Moscow, but we're no different. So these worthy victims, this is a term that comes from Herman and Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent. So what are worthy victims? Worthy victims are Ukrainians. It allows us to paint ourselves as empathetic and compassionate and just. It is used to demonize the aggressor. All our aggressors, like Putin or Saddam Hussein, become the new Hitler. It really is a way of kind of, it's a form of self-adulation. We are good, they are evil. And you use, states use worthy victims to express this kind of self-righteous outrage, and of course a very poisonous nationalism. And fact-based evidence is abandoned. We saw this with Iraq. It charlatans and con artists and fake defectors and opportunists, many in the media, become experts that essentially just fuel the conflict. I mean, in that column I write about George Clooney and celebrities who couldn't make trips fast enough to Darfur to denounce the war crimes being committed by Khartoum. I work the Southern Sudan, so I'm not minimizing what happened there. But at the same time, of course, the United States was killing scores of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they weren't going there. And this is always the case. I write in the column about one of the ironies that happened when I was in El Salvador in 1984 reporting the war. We had a Catholic priest from Poland who was murdered, and this, you couldn't hear about his death enough. And it was used by the Reagan administration to excoriate the Polish communist government. And yet, 4 years before, four Catholic missionaries, American, had been raped and murdered by the Salvadoran National Guard. And the Reagan administration blamed the three nuns and a lay worker for their own deaths. I mean, Jean Kirkpatrick, who was the ambassador to the United Nations, said they weren't just nuns, they were political activists. Secretary of State Alexander Haig speculated that perhaps they ran a roadblock. And then, of course, in Salvador, they had assassinated Archbishop Oscar Romero in March of 1990. That was before the nuns were killed. I mean, by the time, between 77 and 89, the whole period of the Salvadoran Civil War, you had 13 priests killed in El Salvador, but nobody wept any tears over them because they weren't worthy victims.
Well, and following up on that same vein, Chris, the censorship, for example, that is taking place in Russia now, speaking of the media, is something, of course, we oppose, and we can get into our high hats about that too. The co-founder of WikiLeaks, who you referred to before on that cable that you referred to that was released by WikiLeaks, co-founder Julian Assange, he's in jail in London, where the U.S. is trying to have him extradited back to America and stand trial, where he would face 175 years in prison. What did he do? Well, he was honest enough, and not honest enough of a journalist to report the hideous war crimes the U.S. committed in Iraq and Iran and so forth, and so therefore he has to be silenced, and he has to be extradited and thrown in prison and so forth. Am I wrong to raise this matter of what is happening to Assange as we talk about, well, Putin's far more extreme silencing of the press in Russia and also the way the media in this country handles a war by Russia in a very different manner than they handle wars by the United States, of which there have been more of, I might add?
No, the hypocrisy is kind of stunning. Julian Assange never committed a crime. In fact, he's the most important publisher or journalist of our generation, hands down. So I think for those of us who spent 20 years outside the United States, it's all deeply disheartening, especially the way the media has once again served as cheerleaders for this bifurcation of the world into us and them. But of course, we have to remember that this is what the public often wants to hear, because at its core, it's really about us as being superior people. And that's been a pretty hard thing to deliver, given the last two decades of the war crimes that we have committed. And let's not forget that we just shut down RT America, where I had a show.
Yes, yes.
Contact was shut down. Now, I denounced the war in a very fierce post on SheerPost that was picked up by Salon and other sites called The Greatest Evil is War. I mean, I, in the first line, called what Putin did a war crime. And that may very well have ended my run at RT. I suspect it probably would have, but they deplatformed RT so quickly that 6 days later it went black. So what, you know, I always tell people, if they want to find out why, and RT had a very small media footprint. It's not like it reached, millions and millions of Americans' households. But it gave a voice, as the Director of National Intelligence report in 2017 complained, to third-party candidates, Black Lives Matter activists, Occupy activists, anti-fracking activists. That was their complaint. There's about 7 pages in that report on RT. And while they decry it as a tool of Russian propaganda, all of the examples they cite are about giving voice to dissidents. That has been combined with the use of algorithms to shadow ban people such as myself. That's not conjecture. In the last year that I was at Truthdig, before we all went on strike because the wealthy publisher decided to fire Bob Scheer and opposed our efforts to form a union, the IT people did a graph of impressions. So when you went into Google and you typed imperialism, if I had something recent on that topic, it would come up. And referrals to the site from impressions had declined from over 700,000 to below 200,000. They're probably, and of course they've managed to erase WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. The whole debacle over the contents in Hunter Biden's laptop, which the New York Post published for 2 weeks, the New York Post was blocked from its own Twitter account, and you had every media organization, bar none, and The Intercept, they were all shouting the New York Times that this was Russian disinformation. I mean, it's interesting that the Times just ran a story on the charges against Hunter Biden, and they went back and actually said that all of the contents were real. None of it was Russian disinformation, but this was essentially, they were doing their job to defeat Trump, the kind of liberal press. And I worry about that, because with a breakdown of standards like that, then all the Trump supporters and all the people on the right go, well, you know, they lie, and they're not wrong. They lie just like we do. The state of the American press is worse than anemic. I've now set up chrishedges.substack.com because Bob Scheer doesn't have any money. I don't have any money. I want to reconstitute my show, which was on Telesur and on Contact, and keep writing my column. But we have been so cornered. I mean, the walls are just closing in a very frightening way. And I think we can't be naive that some of the biggest proponents of censorship come from the Democratic Party and, of course, Silicon Valley, which is linked now with the Biden campaign. Now, what gives Google, Facebook, Twitter the right to censor? We know nothing about these people, how they make decisions. They know everything about us. Of course, Silicon Valley pumped out hundreds of millions of dollars. We don't know how much, because it's all, with our wonderful campaign laws, it's all black, it's all dark money. But hundreds of millions of dollars of anti-Trump ads in the last few weeks of the campaign. And of course, the quid pro quo is the Democrats won't break up their monopoly.
Thank you for that, Chris. And before we move on, let me do say on behalf of Julian Assange, if you want to learn more, listeners, about the real life and death struggle of Julian Assange and what it means to freedom of the press, or what's left of freedom of the press in this country, I would encourage you to go to the website for the Defense Committee. It's simply AssangeDefense.org, AssangeDefense.org. Check that out, my friends.
Chris, talk about the no-fly zone over the Ukraine. President Zelensky gave a speech last week to Congress calling for it, and it's a popular demand. Biden so far has said that he wouldn't do it, that it would drag America and NATO into what could be a world war. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, that is an act of war, because essentially you are dominating the airspace, and if Russia seeks in any way to enter that airspace, they become a target. That's a recipe for war. So people who are clamoring for a no-fly zone are insane. I was at the Veterans for Peace rally in Times Square, I guess it was last week, which was filled with people waving Ukrainian flags and calling for a no-fly zone. I mean, it's kind of like the summer of 1914, with huge crowds swarming out into the center of Berlin or Vienna, clamoring for war. What they were clamoring for was suicidal folly that essentially, you know, took the lives of millions of working class men for nothing. But I think the military establishment I mean, who understand that kind of logistics. What they want is Ukraine to, they want to turn Ukraine into Chechnya or the old Afghanistan when Brzezinski decided to arm the Taliban and or all these jihadists would become the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to destroy the Soviet Union. And that's what we're seeing. So we're seeing staggering sums of weapons pumped into the Ukraine. And the, of course, the idea is to bleed Russia. But the people who will really bleed in order to achieve this policy decision, of course, will be the Ukrainians. And the fact that the last vestiges of the American left are clamoring for this is, again, a kind of, you know, disheartening window into what's happened to the American political establishment. I mean, the U.S. is now giving $13.6 billion, I think he just gave more, in military humanitarian assistance. They gave him $200 million in military assistance. I think they just gave him, I can't remember the figure, another $100 million or something. You have the 5,000-strong EU rapid deployment force being recruited. You see the German government has announced that they will, for the first time since World War II, ship arms to another country. The Germans have said they will now raise their military budget to twice the amount of the old budget, and that they will now raise the defense budget to more than 2% of GDP. And that essentially moves the German military from the seventh largest in the world to the third behind China and Russia, but not China and the United States. And then you have, again, this was an agreement the Clinton administration made to Moscow that they would not deploy NATO troops in these NATO-allied countries in Central and Eastern Europe. That was violated. You have battle groups now with the Ukraine crisis being doubled in size in the Baltic states, I think to more than 6,000 troops, 9,000 troops, U.S. troops in Poland. Battle groups are being sent to Romania, Slovakia. I've covered war, and this is wars, once you, even if you station troops in a defensive posture, one mistake, one overreach. I mean, we had a missile strike 12 miles from the Polish border. We have Moscow saying that they will attack convoys coming in from the West with weapons for the Ukrainians. I mean, it has, you don't control it. Once you open that Pandora's box, it controls you. And history has shown that. And so what we're flirting with here is really potentially catastrophic and not, you know, we can't rule out the possibility of a nuclear confrontation. The more you corner Putin, and just to say about the sanctions are so draconian that they're clearly designed to destroy Putin. That's the goal. And cornering Putin at this particular moment, especially after provoking and aggravating Putin and lying, betraying, that's the right word, this is just folly. But, of course, the arms industry made a fortune off, and they're making a fortune off the Ukraine crisis. Their stocks, indeed, by the way, have all rocketed upwards.
Surprise, surprise. And of course, those sanctions, by the way, which are hurting the Russian people far more than they're hurting the oligarchs or Putin, are an act of war and violation of international law, by the way. But continuing on, and on the notion of some kind of peaceful settlement being negotiated here, from our own media, we simply hear of Russia being very obstinate and so forth and so on. But there have been reports that in a recent round, Chris, of talks between the warring parties, that Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson and Putin confidant, said that Russia's war in Ukraine would end in a minute, as he put it, if Ukraine was willing to give up seeking entry into NATO and would let the areas of Donetsk and Luhansk become independent states, recognize that Crimea was now a part of Russia. And apparently when Zelensky of the Ukraine heard this, he didn't reject it out of hand. So what do you see as possible ways out of this, possible ways that this could be settled, what it might mean going forward? And should the U.S. Or China be involved in these discussions of a resolution?
Well, this has been a long-standing Russian demand. This isn't new. And both the Ukraine and NATO refuse to categorically rule out inclusion of the Ukraine. And the Russian request for Ukrainian neutrality is not unreasonable. In fact, I think it's very reasonable. The problem is that Ukraine in many ways has become a de facto NATO country because you have U.S. advisors. I think we had 150 advisors in there. It's been flooded with NATO weaponry, and of course that has just been increased with the conflict. And I find the Russian demands, and you go back again to 1989, that era when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was absolutely universal understanding that Russia had legitimate security concerns. You know, it's why the Obama administration, and not an administration I have much admiration for, but they did not ship weapons to the Ukraine. That was begun by Trump and of course continued by Biden, because they understood that the Ukraine was part of Russia's natural sphere of influence. My father was a cryptographer in Tehran at the Tehran conference for Roosevelt, and that conference laid out, gave Stalin that kind of assurance that Allied forces would not move up to the border of Russia. That's what it was about. Churchill and Roosevelt understood, as did the policymakers and diplomats in 1989 and during the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Chris, unfortunately, we're coming to an end to our allotted time. And before I ask you to give our audience again that Substack reference so that people can stay tuned to you, I want to tell you that on behalf of all of us at Law and Disorder, in an act of solidarity with you, our airways are open to you anytime you want to come on. We're totally support you and understand what they're trying to do, and we're here on your side. Chris, tell people how they can get in touch with you.
It's chrishedges.substack.com, and the hope is that I get enough subscribers that I can produce my own show now and continue it independently. But that's really where independent journalists have been left, really appealing to the readers. The model, the corporate model doesn't work. The model of depending on the wealthy doesn't work. It's really in our hands now.
Yeah. Repeat that one more time, please.
It's chrishedges.substack.com.
Well, until next time, Chris Hedges, we so thank you for being with Law and Disorder today, coming on today. And as Michael has said, you're welcome anytime.
Great, great. Thank you so much.
Be well, Chris. Take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Sada Shakur is an inspiration to many young black and brown activists today. She was a member of the Black Panther Party in New York in 1968 when FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover said the Black Panthers were the single greatest threat to the internal security of the country. Hoover launched the COINTEL program to eliminate the Black Panthers. When the Panthers broke up, Asada became a member of the Black Liberation Army. She was seriously wounded and apprehended in 1973 by state troopers in a shootout on a New Jersey highway. She was tried and convicted of murdering a state trooper, even though the medical evidence showed that she was badly injured and could not have fired a gun. Asada escaped from prison in 1979, and 5 years later she was given political asylum in revolutionary Cuba, where she lives today. The FBI has put a $2 million bounty on her head. She has a target on her back, inasmuch as she is wanted dead or alive. We speak today with Donna Murch, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Professor Murch, who specializes in African American and U.S. history, Black radicalism, and history of mass incarceration, is known as the historian of the Black Panther Party. She has recently written the book Asada Taught Me, State Violence, Racial Capitalism, and the Movement for Black Lives, published by Haymarket Books. In it, she analyzes the forces giving rise to Black power and Black radicalism, mass incarceration, the militarization of the police who target people of color, and the genesis of Black Lives Matter. Donna Murch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What is the carceral state and what are its manifestations?
So the term carceral state has really become popular among activists and scholars over the past 10 or 15 years. It was originally coined by Michel Foucault, and the word carceral is derived from the Latin carcere, for prison. But people have chosen the term as a way to talk about broadly the punishment powers of the state. So not just prisons or police, but all elements that would be associated with punishment and imprisonment. That could include the foster care system, social welfare system, a variety of different types of state agencies and functions. So in that sense, the carceral state is an analytic framework that allowed a broader approach to the punishment capacities of the state than just traditional policing and prisons.
Please discuss the origins of racialized mass incarceration and the role Bill and Hillary Clinton played in furthering mass incarceration.
Well, the term mass incarceration, again, I think that we've had a movement inside the university that is very much linked to the organizing outside. And the term mass incarceration has been used for a long time, but only recently, really in the last decade, have historians begun to systematically write about the history of mass incarceration and the carceral state. So generally, this term is used to refer to the early 1970s, when the total prison population, that includes state and federal, begins to rise at large numbers. And it's in the early 70s that the United States prison population balloons and grows many, many fold. The 1990s, under the Clinton administration, Democrats, new Democrats as they call themselves, was actually the single biggest period of increase in the total numbers of people incarcerated in state and federal. So an important concept in thinking about U.S. history is that the development of this mass incarceration system, and I would just add that disproportionate targeted incarceration of populations of color has existed since before even the founding of our republic. So incarceration and racialized incarceration is not new, but it's in the early 1970s that the numbers balloon and just really metastasize. And it's a system that has been built across party. So it's been a bipartisan state-building campaign in many ways, and it was under a Democrat that it expanded the most.
What are the roots of the conflation of blackness with criminality, and how did the war on drugs become a war on black people? What is racial capitalism?
So I think that in some ways, we do have to talk about populations of color because, of course, Samoan and Pacific Islanders in California have the highest rate of incarceration. We also have very high rates of police killings, incarceration of Native and Indigenous populations and African Americans. So I think that the overlapping processes in the United States as a settler colonial enterprise that linked the seizure of Native land and Indigenous land with the development of African slavery. So I think the deep, deep roots of this system of incarceration is rooted in those overlapping processes in which race is the core foundation. I think it's necessary when thinking about how to organize about against this, it's necessary to think about how capitalism intersects with state functions. And so many of us who are writing the histories of carceral state and incarceration are interested in the process of racial capitalism, which is an argument that both capitalism as a system is built in foundational ways on under race, and that race itself can't be understood without an interrogation of capitalism. The term is taken from Cedric Robinson, who included it in his book on Black Marxism, and he got it from his studies of South Africa and South African activists in the 1970s, who were using this term really in the context of organizing, because they were trying to explain the portions of the Black movement that they found difficult to organize, because in many ways they were benefiting from the extractive nature of the South African economy, and at the same time, the problem of talking about race without a critical material dimension. So it comes actually out of the South African struggle, and Cedric Robinson and peers of his became interested in how do we apply this to the United States and other parts of the world.
For those of you who have just tuned in, we're speaking with Professor Donna Murch from Rutgers University. She's just written the book, Asada Taught Me, State Violence, Racial Capitalism, and the Movement for Black Lives, an excellent book put out by Haymarket Books. We urge everybody to get it. Donna, what led to what you call the extreme militarization of policing, focused on the criminalization, control, and prison warehousing of an entire generation of black and brown youth? What is it, the counterinsurgency campaign against urban protests and black and brown power organizations?
In 1965, with the founding of the War on Poverty, it also had contained within it the War on Crime. And it was a response partially to the urban rebellions. Watts, at that time, was the largest urban rebellion in history. It was later superseded by the 1992 Los Angeles Rebellion. And the state response to this at the local level in Los Angeles was the establishment of the Strategic Weapons Assault Team, later known as SWAT, which became a new kind of policing. All of the first members of SWAT were ex-military from Korea and Vietnam, and it was really taking ex-veterans themselves and taking the counterinsurgency ideas and practices that were being used in Vietnam and other anti-communist wars sponsored by the United States throughout the world, and then applying that to domestic Los Angeles. This concept of this type of policing, and of course the name SWAT, spread across the country, and it became one of the major tools of the war on drugs. So I think at its core, a lot of counterinsurgency practices grew out both of the United States internationalist history of imperialist and anti-communist warfare. There was always a cross-fertilization with what was done abroad with what came home, combined with this real threat and criminalization of mass upheaval. One piece that I would add to that is that this is inseparable from the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement, in which you have in 1965 the signing of the Voting Rights Act, and then less than a week later, once we have the legal dismantling of Jim Crow in the South, we have this massive outbreak of protest in Los Angeles, and many people signaled that as the ways in which people were trying to fight these deep economic, material, and structural life of race outside the South, which includes redlining, violent policing, unequal schools, inability to influence local government and shape the community control of education and health.
What was the catalyst for the Black Lives Matter movement that led to the largest mass demonstrations in the history of the United States?
Well, you know, that's a complex question because I think the immediate catalyst, if, you know, we use that if we're talking about a reaction, a chemical reaction, would be the murder of Trayvon Martin and the simultaneous development of these networks of activists that can be traced back to an earlier period, but it was in the summer of 2012 following the acquittal of Darren Wilson for killing Trayvon Martin that we first saw the term Black Lives Matter used. But as historians, we are always looking for the longer histories and how did this come about? Because of course there have been many, many police killings, and why did Trayvon Martin become so central to this? And I think that the 2009 killing of Oscar Grant in Oakland, who was killed by a transit officer in Oakland, that was the first time that I saw this kind of coalition come together in recent history. You can, of course, go back to earlier killings like Yulia Love in Los Angeles or Eleanor Bumpers in New York, and you saw protest. But I think this is really a younger generation of activists who use police killings as a way to understand the diminution of Black life. I also, as a historian of the war on drugs and the Black Panther Party, I also think that in many ways, this emergence of mass incarceration and the total numbers of people incarcerated, the expansion of police powers, the use of asset forfeiture, which incentivized local police departments to prosecute the drug war versus other kinds of crimes, this was an enormous assault on community. And I think it took some decades for people to figure out how to organize against it. So I think even though the Black Lives Matter movement starts with a focus on police killings, I think it is a larger confrontation with this thing that we're calling the carceral state. It's, of course, linked to prison abolition. So I think it has both short and long-term causes.
Donna Murch, the Black Panther Party came out of Oakland, California in the 1960s. You write about the migration of Black people from states like Louisiana to California during World War II so they could find jobs. Please talk about the base of the Black Panther Party coming from several college campuses in the San Francisco Bay Area and then spreading into the community and organizing in those communities.
Yes. Well, you know, the story of the Black Panther Party is really where my book begins. And of course, its title is drawn from Assata Shakur, who was part of the New York Black Panther Party and then the Black Liberation Army. But the origins of the Panthers were different than they were initially thought. They were always described as being the ultimate antithesis to the Southern nonviolent civil rights movement. But the Black Panther Party was actually formed by Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, and a whole generation of young people who were first-generation migrants from the South. They migrated to the Bay Area, largely because of the new opportunities in the defense industry in the 1940s for their parents, and they got unprecedented access to education. Much of it was a problematic education. Huey Newton said that the public education system in Oakland was one of the things that harmed him most as a child, but nevertheless, there was a huge expansion in education and literacy compared to these people coming from the rural South. And many of these young people who had these really traumatic and disturbing experiences in Oakland public schools were able to attend higher education because in California in the post-war period, higher education at all three levels, community college, state, and the University of California was free. So in some cases, people had dropped out of high school, gotten GEDs, and under the California Master Plan, anyone with a high school diploma or equivalency had the right to attend higher education. So the real genesis point from the Black Panther Party was actually in Merritt College, a community college located just on the edge of West Oakland, which was the core Black population settlement of new migrants. And it was there that people began talking and organizing, and they joined a study group called the Afro-American Association. I would add Kamala Harris's parents were also members of the Afro-American Association. And then ultimately, the study group split up. You had a left faction that wanted more direct forms of confrontation, that also thought capitalism was at the core of racial inequality. And it's out of that tendency from the study groups in public education, the urban campuses of both Northern and Southern California, that the Panthers emerge.
Professor Murch, what was the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party?
The 10-point program was drafted by Bobby Seale and Huey Newton in mid-October 1966. And it was essentially a platform for a new organization that called for the right of education for all, for full employment, and also for Black men to no longer serve in the military, and the right of self-determination. The first plank in the 10-point program was the right of self-determination. So it combined, interestingly, socialist goals like full employment, right to housing, and resistance to the military, but it wed that to a program of, at that time, what was called revolutionary nationalism, influenced by Malcolm X, and the right, essentially, of self-determination of Black communities. The Panthers, as they evolve, later repudiate actual revolutionary nationalism. They then become revolutionary internationalists, and then ultimately they repudiate the state system altogether and call themselves intercommunalists, because they were interested in ways to create non-statist connections with different communities around the world, especially those fighting on Ho Chi Minh's side in the so-called Vietnam War.
We're talking to Donna Murch, the author of the just-published book, Asada Taught Me. Donna, please describe Asada Shakur's background. She was not from California, but she did go out there. What influenced her? How did she become politically active? And where did she organize? Talk about her apprehension and her trial.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, one of the things that's really striking is that it's Asada Shakur, number one, who is a woman, two, who's from New York, so the New York chapter of the Black Panther Party, and then the splinter faction that broke off from the Oakland leadership called the Black Liberation Army. So I think that one thing that's so interesting is that it's not the party's founders who have been the real influence for the Movement for Black Lives today. It's Asada Shakur. She also was a migrant. Her family was from the Carolinas and then migrated and settled in New York. She had similar experiences to those described by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale of experiencing racism in the schools, being confronted with it in New York. And she, too, is politicized while attending a community college. In the early 70s, she was accused of the killing of a New Jersey law enforcement officer. She was arrested and had multiple trials. In response to this, there was a very strong defense, different kinds of solidarity and defense committees created to defend her. And I teach at Rutgers, which was one of the biggest sites of defense committees for Asada Shakur. Ultimately, she was convicted and was sentenced and then was later broken out of a federal penitentiary and became a fugitive to Cuba. Her autobiography, which she wrote in the late 80s, Asada, has been the inspiration for so many generations of leftists and Black radicals. And that's really my starting point for thinking about Asada Taught Me.
Asada Taught Me, a very great book. Asada Shakur wrote a poem called Affirmation. I wonder if, Donna, if you could please read the short poem Affirmation before we have to say goodbye.
Sure. This short affirmation is said at almost all of the different meetings I've attended from different groups within the Movement for Black Lives. It is our duty to fight for freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love and protect one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Thank you very much.
Donna Murch, how can people get in touch with you and keep up with your important work?
Oh, thank you for that question. Well, you can reach me. I have a faculty page at Rutgers that has a link to my website. And the book is being published by Haymarket Press. So if you type in Donna Murch, M-U-R-C-H, Haymarket, the book should come up.
Donna Murch, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Donna.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Next day, the absolute latest in headlines, top world and U.S. headline news from the opening of today's Democracy Now, with hosted by Amy Goodman, and then we'll go to the latest tax cast from the Tax Justice Network, which came up just about 48 hours ago. So we've got some good stuff coming up for the remainder of the show today. I may get back with you with some more details on programming and just after the tax cast airs. Here we go. It's the latest Democracy Now! Headlines.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations says more than half of Ukraine's children have been forced to flee their homes in the months since Russia invaded Ukraine. It's one of the largest mass displacements of children since the Second World War. This morning, Ukraine's military said it destroyed a large Russian landing ship docked in the occupied city of Berdyansk on the Black Sea. In northern Ukraine, about 150,000 residents of Chernihiv are without heat and electricity and have been forced to ration drinking water after Russia bombed a key bridge linking their city to the capital, Kyiv. Ukrainian officials have accused Russian forces of holding Chernihiv hostage amidst fears it could suffer the same fate as Mariupol, the besieged Black Sea port city that's been devastated by weeks of Russian attacks. On Wednesday, Mariupol residents emerged from bomb shelters to bury their dead as warmer weather allowed them to dig temporary graves. This is Victoria, whose stepfather was killed by Russian troops.
My stepfather, he was in that car and they blew him up. He was at first coming our way and got wounded. Then a doctor and a young guy who was with them started helping, and they got blown up in the car. It has gotten warmer, and so now we could bury him.
Russian reporter Oksana Balina was killed by Russian artillery fire alongside another civilian while reporting in the capital, Kyiv. On Wednesday, the U.S. State Department formally declared Russia's military has committed war crimes in Ukraine. The U.S. expelled 12 Russian diplomats at the United Nations, accusing them of espionage. Russia said it would expel U.S. diplomats in response. President Biden's in Brussels for an emergency NATO summit. NATO's announced it's sending more troops to Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia. Over the past month, the number of NATO troops in Eastern Europe has reached about 40,000, double the number from just a month ago. On Wednesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov condemned Poland's proposal to send NATO peacekeeping forces into Ukraine, saying that would lead to a direct clash between Russian troops and NATO forces. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has once again rejected calls to boycott Russian oil and gas, saying the cost to Germany's economy will be too high. Scholz spoke Wednesday at the Bundestag, that's the German parliament.
Yes, we will end this dependency as quickly as we possibly can, but to do that from one day to the next would mean plunging our country and the whole of Europe into a recession. Hundreds of thousands of jobs would be at risk.
Germany gets about a third of the oil it consumes from Russia and about half its coal and natural gas. On Wednesday, activists with Greenpeace painted the slogans, "Oil fuels war" and "Oil is war," on the side of a massive Russian tanker in the Baltic Sea, delivering 100,000 tons of crude to a port in Rotterdam.
Since the war started, over 230 tankers have left Russia with oil and oil products, meaning it's almost business as usual, and it finances Putin's war against Ukraine.
The U.S. Supreme Court's rejected new state legislative maps drawn up by Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers and accepted by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, a major win for Republicans. The new map added one black majority assembly district in the Milwaukee area. The ruling is the first time the U.S. Supreme Court overturned state-drawn maps this redistricting cycle. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who dissented on the ruling alongside Justice Elena Kagan, called the majority's decision unprecedented. In more Supreme Court news, Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee ramped up their attacks on nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson during her final day of questioning Wednesday. Jackson, who's the first black woman nominated to the high court, was accused by Lindsey Graham of judicial activism and grilled by Josh Hawley on a child pornography case. We'll have the latest on the hearings later in the broadcast. This comes as Justice Clarence Thomas, the longest currently serving member of the court, missed oral arguments again Wednesday after being hospitalized for 7 days with an unspecified infection. Idaho has become the first state to enact a law modeled on Texas's near-total ban on abortions. Republican Governor Brad Little signed the bill Wednesday, which bans abortions after around 6 weeks of pregnancy and allows anyone biologically related to the fetus to sue abortion providers if they defy the law. The only exceptions are in cases of medical emergency, rape, or incest, but the latter two require the patient to have reported a crime to police. Also on Wednesday, Oklahoma lawmakers passed a total abortion ban that would be enforced by bounty hunter-style lawsuits. These latest attacks on reproductive rights come nearly 7 months after Texas enacted its near-total ban on abortions. Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent for The Nation, says nearly half of all patients who left Texas and traveled out of state for their abortion have gone to Oklahoma.
Now, the Oklahoma House has passed a total ban on abortion. It bans abortion at fertilization before a pregnancy even implants in the uterus. And if it's passed by the Senate and signed by the governor, it would take effect immediately. One really noteworthy thing about this law, it defines woman as any person whose biological sex is female based on their chromosomes and having a uterus, regardless of gender identity. So again, we really see the intersection of the anti-abortion and anti-trans agenda rolled into this bill that would decimate abortion access in the region.
Moderna says it will ask the FDA to approve emergency use of its COVID-19 shot in children between 6 months and 6 years of age. Moderna says a clinical trial showed two lower doses of its vaccine given 4 weeks apart produced a robust immune response in young children. In Afghanistan, the Taliban closed schools for girls above sixth grade just hours after they reopened, ordering students home after they showed up for classes. This is 16-year-old Khadija from Kabul, one of the many students who was told she had to go home after she excitedly arrived for her first day back in class on Wednesday.
It was like a day of mourning, a very sad day. It was like losing a loved one. Everyone was crying. The girls were hugging and crying and saying goodbye. Even if it would be very difficult, I still wanted to be a doctor. I like doctors' white coats, but now I cannot do anything. My future is ruined.
South Korea and Japan say North Korea has test-fired a new type of intercontinental ballistic missile capable of delivering a nuclear warhead. If confirmed, it would be North Korea's first test launch of an ICBM since 2017. In Washington, D.C., Howard University faculty have called off a planned 3-day strike after agreeing to a tentative contract with the school's administration. Faculty members have been demanding fair wages and improved working conditions for non-tenure track and adjunct educators. Meanwhile, in Sacramento, California, thousands of teachers and school staff went on strike Wednesday over low pay and staffing shortages. In Minneapolis, over 4,500 educators entered their 17th day on strike as negotiations with the school district continue. Here in New York, over 1,000 immigrant workers and their supporters held a protest at the state capitol in Albany Wednesday, calling on lawmakers to include $3 billion in the state budget to support immigrant workers who are excluded from federal pandemic aid. Advocates are also demanding New York create a permanent program that provides unemployment insurance and health care benefits to undocumented workers. Democracy Now! Spoke to Miguel Angel Flores, a construction worker from Mexico who's lived in the United States for 16 years. He was on a bus headed back to Brooklyn after he and other immigrant workers marched to Albany last week.
We came to Albany to tell the governor that we are awake, we are united, and we won't stop fighting until our needs are met. This movement is an example to other states. Immigrants across the country are rising up. We are demanding that our rights be respected and to be treated just like any other citizen who pays taxes.
And former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has died of cancer at the age of 84. Albright served as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations from 1993 to 1997 when President Bill Clinton nominated her to become the first female Secretary of State. Albright was a staunch supporter of U.S. power and defender of authoritarian leaders, including Egypt's Hosni Mubarak and Indonesia's Suharto. She was a key architect of NATO's 78-day bombing of Serbia in 1999. In 1998, she joined President Clinton's foreign policy team in a live CNN event promoting the administration's threat to bomb Iraq into complying with the demands of U.N. weapons inspectors. An exchange between Albright and Columbus Public School teacher John Strange was later billed by the media as the question heard around the world.
What do you have to say about dictators of countries like Indonesia, who we sell weapons to, yet they are slaughtering people in East Timor? What do you have to say about Israel, who is slaughtering Palestinians, who impose martial law? What do you have to say about that? Those are our allies. Why do we sell weapons to these countries? Why do we support them? Why do we bomb Iraq when it commits similar problems?
Examples of things that are not right in this world, and the United States is trying. I really am surprised that people feel that it is necessary to defend the rights of Saddam Hussein, when what we ought to be thinking about is how to make sure that he does not use weapons of mass destruction.
Secretary of State Albright defended the Clinton administration's devastating sanctions against Iraq. In 1996, she was interviewed by Leslie Stahl on CBS's 60 Minutes.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
In 2004, I had a chance to ask Madeleine Albright about those comments as she attended the Democratic National Convention in Boston.
Mary Albright, the question I've always wanted to ask, do you regret having said, when asked, do you think the price was worth it?
I have
the children
said 5,000 times that I regret it. It was a stupid statement. I never should have made it. And if everybody else that has ever made a statement they regret would stand up, there'd be a lot of people standing. I have many, many times said it, and I wish that people would report that I've said it. I wrote it in my book that it was a stupid statement.
Do you think it laid the groundwork for later being able to target Iraq and make it more acceptable on the part of the Bush administration?
What? You've got to be kidding.
Well, the sanctions against Iraq.
The sanctions against Iraq were put on because Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. But there never were sanctions against food and medicine. And you people need to know there never were sanctions against food and medicine. And I was responsible for getting food in there and getting Saddam Hussein to pump oil.
That was former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright speaking to Democracy Now! In 2004. She died on Wednesday at the age of 84. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Well, that was this morning's top headline from Democracy Now!, as you've heard. Madeleine Albright. Oh, man. She even wiggled around that last part. Did you get that? I did not know that she refuted the comment she made about 500,000 dead Iraqi children. But then she had to, I got Saddam to pump his oil. I got him. We can't win for losing sometimes, can we, listeners? All right, well, here we go with the latest. Now, this tax cast, you know, it only comes out once a month from the Tax Justice Network. And this one just came out a day and a half, just recently. This is the first time it's aired on RFK. So here we go. I think they've got some good points. They always have. They, with their financial registry index proposal that is, you know, it's been implemented into law in several parliaments in Europe and other parts of the world where the billionaires, the oligarchs, are having to register their money through the banks they use in whatever country in the world. I mean, that's the way it's got to be. It really has to if we're going to stop this madness. Here we go.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, follow us on Twitter handle thetaxcast. If you want to make sure you never miss a TaxCast, just email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. So, with Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine, even the most hardcore let the planet burn people can no longer deny that fossil fuel dependency is a national and an international security issue. We know the resource curse goes hand in hand with corruption, and this is a time like no other for the world to finally see that the key to it all is financial secrecy. That's a national and an international security issue. Many nations around the world are in denial about why sanctions they're now imposing on super wealthy Russians who got rich from their close connections to the Kremlin aren't really going to work. The inconvenient truth is that the global financial secrecy we've been banging on about for all these years is designed to serve the very wealthy at great cost to almost everyone else, us. And without major transparency changes and investment in law enforcement, sanctions are easily circumvented. Because the interests of the very rich and powerful have shaped our economies and our policies across the world. And as all the Tax Justice Network's financial secrecy indexes consistently show, Britain is the world's worst offender when you combine it with its satellite havens. So this month, on the TaxCast, I'm speaking with journalist and anti-corruption campaigner Oliver Bullough about his excellent new book, Butler to the World: How Britain Became the Servant of Tycoons, Tax Dodgers, Kleptocrats and Criminals. It could hardly be more relevant to these times. I spoke with him just before its release. Your book is connecting all the dots on what's happening now with Russia and Ukraine. You know, we've got the resource curse and the finance curse hand in hand with Butler Britain, all roads leading to financial secrecy and all the things we've all been campaigning about for all these years. Our country has just bowed down to it all. So, I mean, even if people don't care how much British butlering hurts people in other countries, they've got to start understanding now, right, how it rots everything and hurts all of us. I mean, you know, when it comes to Butler Britain, the concept of Britain being a butler to the world, I thought it was such a good way to understand and kind of look at ourselves in the mirror and realise that there's a subservience going on. We're kind of world beating, which we love to talk about, but actually we're world beating at being completely servile to corrupt money. If you were to summarise the situation that's happening right now with Ukraine and Russia, how would you summarise the lessons that we could learn when it comes to the finance curse and our complicity in what's been building up for all these years?
At the moment, quite naturally, there are a lot of comparisons between what Putin is doing in invading Ukraine and Hitler invading Poland in 1939. I think a lot of people looking at that think, well, in that case, there's nothing we can do because we're not going to go to war with someone with nuclear weapons. But the Kremlin is very different to a traditional dictatorship because of the way that the vast majority of the wealth owned by the Kremlin elite is outside Russia. They have offshored their wealth to a vast degree. And that is our fault. You know, I mean, Gabriel Zucman has estimated that up to 60% of the Russian elite's wealth is outside Russia. And that is because they don't trust each other any more than they trust us, right? You know, that system of offshore finance and offshore structures, we in Britain invented that. That's the invention of the City of London. So we are responsible for sorting that out. We broke it. We need to fix it. And we're not just responsible for creating the whole system, but we're also specifically responsible for having welcomed Russian oligarchs' wealth to our country. We have allowed them to fight their court cases in our courts. We've allowed them to use our lawyers to muzzle journalists. We've allowed them to buy our football clubs and, you know, to live in our capital, to keep their children, educated their children here and so on. You know, we have a responsibility to the Ukrainians to sort this out. And You know, I think there are obviously lots of things we need to do for the Ukrainians on a day-to-day basis, but I think the real important service we can do for the Ukrainians and for everyone is to recognize that the money that is coming here and the people for whom we are acting as butlers, that is dirty money and those are dirty people. And we shouldn't welcome them here just because they're rich. And we shouldn't only tackle their wealth because they've invaded Ukraine. We should be doing it anyway. Investigate organized crime only when a gang war breaks out. You investigate it all the time because it's criminal activity. And I think that is what we've got desperately wrong. And I hope if something beneficial comes from this appalling tragedy, it could be that Britain starts to recognize the costs of the butler business and starts getting out of it.
Oh, I really hope so. And I mean, you write about what comes up time and time again is the justifications of the unjustifiable is, oh, everybody else is doing it. So if we don't do it, someone else will do it. And we'll stop when everyone else agrees to stop. And that, you know, democracies really must unify and develop a response to the challenge of dirty money and transnational kleptocracy. Because if we don't wage war on financial secrecy, it's going to eat us all.
Yeah, I agree. You know, you cannot simultaneously have a total unquestioning acceptance of the wealthy from wherever they are and democracy. You can't treat everyone the same before the law and give rich people anything they want, because rich people want to have immunity from the law. When you get down to it, you have to choose one or the other. Do you want democracy or do you want to be a butler? I mean, I, throughout the book, and I try to keep the book light because this is a, you know, it's a depressing subject. Obviously it is. And so I try and keep the book light and funny. And I found, you know, when I was thinking about butlers, obviously I was thinking about the Jeeves and Worcester stories. And actually I found the Jeeves stories a surprisingly good source of parallels for what Britain gets up to. You know, if you strip away the P.G. Wodehouse jokes from the Jeeves stories, they're pretty dark. You know, Jeeves is an astonishingly intelligent, resourceful man who could do or make a success of almost anything. And yet he chooses to deploy his talents to help halfwits to get out of scrapes of their own making. And some of the ways he chooses to do that are right out of Ukraine or Russia. I mean, you know, bribing police officers, assaulting police officers, running an illegal bookmaking operation. And there's a sort of very odd lack of solidarity in Jeeves's world. And P.G. Wodehouse recognized this. I mean, he's very funny. And he has this very entertaining story when a group of revolutionaries come to lunch in Bertie's flat. And one of the, you know, the revolutionaries accuses Jeeves of being an outdated lackey of the ruling class. And Jeeves's response is, "Very good, sir." And you know, and you just know that that's essentially what the response of Boris Johnson's government is to being accused of being a lackey of the Russian ruling class. "You're very good. Very good. What can we do, you know, for you now?" It's just very disappointing that more politicians haven't realized the damage that we as a country are causing by this unquestioning acceptance of really dirty wealth.
It's difficult to challenge British people's ideas about what Britain actually is, and even to challenge what other people around the world think Britain is, because we, you know, cricket and fair play, the rule of law, it's very difficult to challenge that and for people to accept it. It endures this myth that we've told about ourselves all this time.
I agree. I think it's really fascinating. I begin the book with the Suez Crisis. It's an incredibly consequential moment, the Suez Crisis. It's the moment when the British Empire, you know, loses, really. The doom of the British Empire at that point is written. This is the moment when offshore dollar market was born and London's future as an offshore center is essentially set in train. We didn't really want Egypt. We just wanted the canal, but we had to, you know, had to, inverted commas, rule Egypt because we wanted the canal. Egyptian nationalists drove out the British, defeated the British Empire, and this new sort of Egyptian nationalism is born, you know. So, you know, we left as bullies and we came back as butlers. And that's the transformation of Britain, right? The biggest bully on the block is the empire, the biggest empire in the world. Goes bankrupt, but they've still got all the skills. Right? They still know how to be a bully. They just can't afford it anymore. So if someone else wants to be a bully, we can just sidle into the room, cough discreetly and say, "I've, you know, got some ideas for you, sir. Here's what you can do. I don't want to hide your wealth. You want to protect your reputation. Here's what you can do." And so that's the story of the butlering issue, really.
Yes, and one of the best insights into the rot really is your chapter on Scottish limited partnerships. I mean, it sounds like a dry subject, but it really shows what a huge open door there is in Britain to corrupt money. It's one of the many shocking stories in your book. We spoke years ago on the TaxCast about limited partnerships, the Scottish Wild West, and what have we done about it? Nothing. In fact, we've made it even worse. It's one of the most depressing stories in the book.
Yeah, I mean, there are many stories in that book that shocked me when I researched them, but I think the one that shocked me the most was the story of the Scottish Limited Partnerships. The damage done by SLPs to Moldova in 2014, you know, what, a seventh of the entire country's economy vanished in the click of a finger, hidden behind the cover of Scottish Limited Partnerships, is devastating. And, you know, it was an unanswerable case that this needed reform, if only the Scottish Limited Partnership, rather than the whole sink that is companies' house. But instead of reforming the Scottish Limited Partnership, the Treasury said, we need to be more concerned about the competitiveness of the City of London. And instead of that, they produced a new kind of limited partnership, the Private Fund Limited Partnership, which is even less regulated than this already disastrous corporate structure that had moved $1 billion out of Moldova and hundreds of billions through the banks in the Baltic states, you know, the favored money laundering vehicle for an entire generation of ex-Soviet crooks. And how much was it going to save the City of London? You know what, on a really generous estimate, a six-figure sum across the whole of the city over many years, each investment fund maybe 10 grand maybe. You know, for a big investment fund, we're talking about a rounding error. But for the Treasury, they were so desperately worried about, you know, the bad publicity around limited partnerships driving investment funds to Luxembourg or Delaware or wherever, that they had to accommodate this desire, this concern about competitiveness in the City of London. It has allowed us to overlook the devastating damage that these hidden financial flows, hidden by British law, like with SLPs or British companies, the devastating damage this has done to places like Moldova, Russia, Ukraine, as we're talking about at the moment, or more broadly, you know, Angola, Nigeria, Tanzania, you name it. And it really seems to have come to a head in public debate because of the Ukraine crisis. And I really hope that this causes the government to look around and wonder about what it's doing. But I haven't seen any sign yet that politicians or the government in particular has really appreciated what the big challenges are.
No, I mean, the Prime Minister has just said no country is doing more than the UK to tackle this issue. I can really relate to what you write in the book when you say in earlier times, you know, you did all this work on exposing fraudsters and you kind of thought that, well, you know, once we expose these loopholes, they'll be closed because it's obvious that it's outrageous. And the Scottish Limited Partnerships is a really good example. It would have been easy to fix that. And I mean, I saw that Daria Kaleniuk of the Anti-Corruption Action Centre in Ukraine was trying to hold the British Prime Minister to account, saying, you know, all that money, all our money went to London. And I dug out an interview I did with her back in 2014 after the fall of Yanukovych, and she said, Europe must change. They've got to stop taking our money. But it just encapsulates what Butler Britain really is all about. I mean, the lax law enforcement, the lack of any action, it's just absolutely part and parcel of the shame that, you know, we feel all these years trying to do something, and it's just really frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, Daria Kaleniuk, who is, as you know, one of the bravest and most imaginative and resourceful people in the world, really, have done an astonishing amount to drive through a reform agenda in Ukraine. It often feels like it's her and like three mates against the entire oligarch class. And yet, you know, okay, they haven't won, but they've done a lot. They've achieved a lot. But, you know, in 2014, the last time we really said we were going to help Ukraine, you know, this was our moment to help Ukraine. They had a Ukraine forum in London to say, how can we help Ukraine? And Daria was there and was name-checked by Theresa May, who was then Home Secretary, to say, you know, she's here representing civil society. We promised, Daria, we're going to really help you this time. You know, this time's going to be different. Nothing happened. You know, unexplained wealth orders were passed, and yet the National Crime Agency wasn't given the resources it needed to make use of them. You know, it's like every time there's a crisis, the government passes a new law, and that's it. It's like producing a new weapon and putting it down and then not paying any soldiers to use it. It's just infuriating. You can't battle oligarchs' wealth on the cheap. You need to battle it as fiercely as they're going to defend it, because, you know, it's existential for them. I don't see any sign that the government has appreciated what needs doing, and it's incredibly frustrating.
It is frustrating, and you just kind of feel like grabbing people around the throat and kind of saying, you fools, you know. And you know, you write about Dmitry Firtash, one of the super rich people, that's it's just the most incredible story that you describe about how quickly somebody like that can rise in, you know, be shaking the hands of royalty and getting invited to parliament and all the rest of it. The doors are just completely open. They can buy passports, buy politics, buy the law.
Buy a tube station, in his case. He bought an actual tube station. I mean, that was amazing, right? I mean, you know, Dmitry Firtash, for the listeners who don't know him, was Gazprom's, the Russian gas companies, Putin's favorite companies. He was their partner in Ukraine. He was the man who sold Russian gas in Ukraine. He was in charge of the transit trade, which was the big earner for Ukrainian politicians. If you controlled the gas transit trade in Ukraine, that was it. You controlled Ukraine to a large extent. And he was Putin's man in Ukraine, and he made this absolute fortune. They took on the post-revolutionary government after 2004 and destroyed it. They destroyed the Orange Revolution coalition, and Firtash made an absolute fortune with his share, and he brought it to London, and he bought himself a mansion, and he bought himself a place on the Guild of Benefactors of Cambridge University. He got to meet, as a result, Prince Philip. He opened trading on the London Stock Exchange. He met John Bercow, the Speaker of the House of Parliament, and the Ministry of Defence sold him a tube station. And that was in, what, 8 years? You know, in 2006, when Global Witness tried to write about him, they couldn't find a photograph. All this time, while the British establishment was welcoming him, selling him anything he wanted, the Americans were calmly and patiently looking into the origins of his fortune, investigating him. And just days after the sale was finalized of the old Brompton Road tube station, they indicted him on an FBI arrest warrant. And ever since, he's been battling extradition to the US. And I'm not saying America is perfect. Obviously, America has plenty of problems with illicit wealth, but just the difference in the law enforcement response to oligarchs is just shown so clearly in the fact that, as far as I know, no one in this country checked the origin of his wealth. After he was arrested in Vienna on the FBI arrest warrant, British politicians said, oh, there were no concerns over the origin of his fortune. But it's just simply not true that there were no suspicions raised by the Americans about the origin of his fortune. It's just that we much preferred taking the cash to doing the work. And that's Butler Britain right there, really.
Yes, and the hypocrisy is so breathtaking. On the one hand, in the EU, we're seeing this outpouring of help for Ukrainians running from the war. At least 10 million are now displaced. And then contrast that with the meanness of Britain. Yes, we'll take Ukrainian and Russian corrupt money and enable the crooks that have fed into all this mess, but we're going to make it really hard for you Ukrainians to shelter from the storm. But if you're rich, well, then there's total freedom of movement with golden visa schemes, passports for sale. It's an open door policy, no questions asked. Russians have donated millions to the governing Conservative Party. They're the second biggest donors after the City of London. And now they're shouting about how they're taking tough action.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the more dispiriting headline-catching gimmicks that the government has come out with in response to the current Ukraine crisis is the banning of golden visas. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm all in favour of getting rid of golden visas. But the idea that this is going to take on and tackle the Russian oligarchs on its own is ludicrous. You know, before 2015, there were no checks of any kind on the money that was used to buy gold and visas. It could come from any financial institution anywhere in the world. And once it was here, you bought your visa and that was it. And since when they brought in, well, didn't bring in checks, but you had to pay the money from a UK financial institution, the number of visas being sold really, you know, dropped quite sharply. Simultaneously, Malta started selling passports and everything. So there were alternatives. But all of those people who bought their visas before 2015, you know, it takes 5 years of residency to get indefinite leave to remain, and then 1 year of indefinite leave to remain to become a citizen. So that's 6 years, and that all happened 7 years ago. So all of those people are now citizens. So what has this achieved? You're shutting the stable door after the horse has, you know, I don't know, gone and bought itself a house in Surrey. It's just infuriating. And, you know, there seems to be still a willingness to just splash these gimmicks on the BBC website or in the newspapers without interrogating whether they're actually going to achieve anything. Because you don't get rid of dirty money or oligarchs by changing the immigration system 7 years after the oligarchs have already got here, obviously. I'm hopeful that, you know, more people will start recognizing that the money is already here, that the money is inherently corrupting, and that we need to properly deploy an army of investigators and law enforcement agents to go back over the previous transactions and look at them and see whether the money should have been here in the first place. Because yes, it's important to stop more coming, but that's not enough. You know, we need to go back and do the work that we didn't do in the past. It's going to be really hard. You know, these people employ seriously good lawyers, but it's not impossible. It's only difficult because we choose not to do it. We really need to take the threat to the integrity of our society caused by our elite essentially becoming butlers to crooks really seriously.
Yeah, I can never decide whether politicians who make these silly statements actually understand that what they're saying is just complete bullshit about tackling it, or whether they just perfectly well know, and it's probably a combination of both. But I know that you wrote about appearing in Parliament to give evidence to a select committee, and the first question was, well, how big is the scale of money being laundered through Britain? And it's just, where do you start?
Well, it was worse. It was worse. It was the question came from Priti Patel, who's currently the Home Secretary, and she asked how much Russian money is there. And what does that question even mean? Sort of, you know, if money came 20 years ago and it's been here for 20 years, is that naturalized yet? If Russian money's come via, you know, a shadow trade at Deutsche Bank, is that Russian money? If it's come via Cyprus, is that Russian money? It's like, you know, if it's been washed around the world a couple of times and come in via a shell company in the British Virgin Islands, is that Russian money? It's, you know, if the Russian in question is a naturalized British citizen, is it still Russian money? This idea that, you know, Russian money is like the Red Army, it crosses your border and you can say, well, there you go, there's 100,000 Red Army soldiers, you can count them, as if that's how money works. It's so sort of illiterate and just, you're right. I mean, do politicians just not understand? And I think that probably they don't. I'm generally, and I often get criticized for this, I don't think anyone is like a Bond villain sitting on a swivel chair cackling to themselves about ruining the world. Most people want to make the world a better place, and often they just don't appreciate that what they're doing has tremendously harmful effects for other people. So I don't think that, genuinely, I don't think that the Treasury officials who, you know, decided not to do anything about Scottish Limited Partnerships, I don't think they meant to do harm to Moldova. I just don't think they knew or cared. And I firmly believe that if we can explain the damage that, you know, what Nick Shatson calls the finance curse does, and, you know, and what I write about is, you know, the butler to the world problem, that by earning this money, we are causing a greater amount of damage overseas. I'm really hopeful that we can turn politicians away from it and towards a more constructive way of earning a living. Maybe I'm naive.
Yeah, well, I like your optimism, and in so many ways you have to think like that, otherwise you'd go and live in a cave somewhere and you know, completely disconnect from the world. But it seems so bloody obvious to me that the very wealthy that put assets in their own name, they call the stupid rich, right? And I mean, it's just so obvious that if you allow anonymous ownership, then you are opening the doors wide to corruption. Why is it so difficult to understand?
It's really interesting trying to find positive arguments in favor of anonymous ownership. I always find it interesting.
It is. You write quite a lot, and it's very depressing, but it's also really shocking and shameful, actually, is how terrible our regulatory bodies are. There's something like 26 regulatory bodies, completely under-resourced, and, you know, they ended up, I think they have £4 million a year for one particular agency, and they tried to prosecute a case and they had to pay out £1.5 million just in one case. And it's just anyone that you ask around the world who's got anything to do with regulation and compliance enforcement just laughs at how pathetic our enforcement is, even of the decent rules that we actually do have.
Yeah, you know, £100 billion is estimated to be laundered through the City of London every year. So clearly something isn't working. Right, that's a lot of money.
And that's a conservative estimate.
Yeah, that's a conservative estimate, but that's the National Crime Agency's own estimate. And I looked at the list of regulators, of whom there are 26 or whatever, 27, I think there might be now, I think they added one. And the situation with accountancy is even worse. You know, you have 8 different regulators. You know, accountants can pick and choose between if they want to, and they don't have to sign up with any of them, but they can pick and choose between them. And those organizations are dependent for their existence on the fees that accountants pay to be regulated. So if an accountancy company doesn't like how it's regulated, they can just go somewhere else, which is a bit like having a referee in a football match who is dependent for his wages on how strict he is to the players. So if he's too strict, they're not going to pay him anymore. So obviously he's not going to be strict. Why would you be? You know, your job is dependent on not being, and that's extraordinary. I mean, and that's just the anti-money laundering regulatory aspect. I mean, then you have, you know, the National Crime Agency, which was set up to be our version of the FBI and yet is desperately underfunded. You know, they have this incredible quote from Lynn Owens, the head of the NCA, to the Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee in this report published in 2020, when asked why they didn't go after more oligarchs. She said, because we are bluntly concerned about the impact on our budget. And so, well, I mean, that is not the sign of a law enforcement agency which is confident about what it's doing. They shouldn't be worried about that. That's absurd. And, you know, and as you say, they tried to bring this case, the unexplained wealth order, against the daughter and grandson of the former president of Kazakhstan, and ended up with £1.5 million in costs, which totally ruined the entire strategy. It's just extraordinary the extent to which, sort of behind the facade of everything looking fine with the, you know, the FATF Financial Action Task Force giving Britain a glowing report of how well it's doing, behind the facade there's just nothing.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's more trained accountants per head of population in the UK than anywhere else in the world, and no wonder. It's not a surprise, is it? I mean, you know, the Tax Justice Network and others, Thomas Piketty and Gabriel Zucman and people like that, have been pressuring for a global asset registry for a long time. I've been reading recently you can own shares through shell companies, so obviously we're going to need a public shareholder registry. We've got to end secret ownership everywhere, end trust secrecy except under very specific circumstances. You know, I mean, here's one. How about, as emergency measures, we freeze all anonymously owned assets wherever possible, and we only unfreeze them when we have full information on the ownership. And obviously, resource law enforcement properly, reform the libel laws, and got to get private money out of financing political parties as well. I mean, that's my list.
Yes, we need all of those things and more. Essentially, people who are wealthy enough to have assets in more than one country have advantages that the rest of us don't have. That's the core mismatch. So in order to combat that, we need to reassert national sovereignty over wealth. We cannot go on as we are. We hear a lot from some politicians, particularly of the right, who claim to oppose globalization and say we need to take back control. But what they're talking about is taking back control from immigrants. They're not talking about taking back control from wealth. But I do think that there is, among a lot of ordinary people, a recognition that something is wrong, that governments don't have the control that governments should have. And the reason for that is because, as you say, money can just flee. You know, anonymously owned assets can just undermine sovereignty. So yes, transparency of ownerships, you can see who owns what in your country. Absolutely, take back control over ownership. You know, proper law enforcement, take back control over the law. Absolutely. You know, those things are crucial. And those two things alone would have a massive effect on the way that oligarchs from everywhere are able to evade paying for the crimes they commit. And the reason they can do that is because Britain has been butler to the world and has helped them do so. So if we got out of the butlering business, it would do a massive amount of good in terms of just stopping this from happening in the first place. Yeah, there are lots of places that would also need to be dissuaded from following in our footsteps, but still, it would be a good start.
Do you think that there's an opportunity now because of what's happening with Ukraine and Russia? You know, they say decades can happen in a few days, but something good could come of this terrible, terrible tragedy that's happening. I find it difficult to look people like Daria Kalenyuk of the Anti-Corruption Action Centre in the eye. You know, I feel really ashamed of my own country, and that's a horrible thing.
I hope that seeing the astonishing damage that kleptocracy does as a system of government to the Russians, to the Ukrainians, to the Georgians, to lots of people, I hope that this gets us out of the butlering game. You know, I don't think we can expect that to happen overnight, but Daria said to me a few years ago when I asked her how she didn't lose faith and lose hope in battling corruption, considering how hard it was in Ukraine, she said she didn't think about conquering corruption. She says, well, we're at 5% now. What can I do to get us to 6? And then if she gets to 6, then that's a win. She marks that up as a win. And I think that's the way to look at it. You know, there is a huge amount of Britain's ruling class that have made a very good living out of being butlers. And they're not going to take easily to me or anyone telling them that they should stop. So, you know, we need to not lose focus. And I think we'll get there.
You've been listening to Oliver Bullough on the TaxCast. His book, Butler to the World, How Britain Became the Servant of Tycoons, Tax Dodgers, Kleptocrats and Criminals, is published by Profile Books. If you're in the United States, you'll have to wait until June 2022. I'll put a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you next month.